Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And boy, it's an exciting time of the year in the culinary world.
It seems to
be. It's happening all the time.
Yeah, indeed it is. And Ann said, what's the theme of today's program? And I said, the theme of today's program is it doesn't have a theme. but it is a grab a bag, shall we say. Of very interesting things
they're very
timely, as you'll hear in due course.
Yes. I mean, to start off with, I just can't say enough good about the Big Burrito Restaurant Group, which is transformative in many ways to the local restaurant scene
here in Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Yeah. And Bill Fuller, who is an old bud of mine, as well as the executive chef and corporate chef and part owner of this wonderful organization of restaurants. Anyhow, the reason for having Bill on is so you can jump anybody within riding or flying or walking distance can jump right into the Hatch Chili Festival that Mad Max is putting on. Let's hear it from Bill.
Well, no, we should say that it's Hatch Chili's. They have a festival for them, but this is the time of the year when you can buy them. And take our advice and take Bill's advice and make sure you get some.
Yeah, I mean, because it's a brief, 3-week season?
Something like that.
And then it's gone.
And we're enjoying it.
Year.
We're enjoying it, and you should enjoy it, too. And Hatch, by the way, is a place.
Yes.
I didn't know that. I originally thought it was a kind of pepper, but
no.
It's a place that's famous for... I understand. Now I understand. So here's the story of Hatch Chili's and what to do with them.
Bill Fuller is corporate chef for a very, very special restaurant group called Big Burrito.
Hey, how you doing?
Bill, yeah, I was trying to remember how long I've known you for and when Big Burrito started in Pittsburgh, but we go back a ways. First, I want to talk about why we're talking exactly now, and that's because we have Hatch Chili Fever. Is that correct?
It's Hatch Chili Harvest Time. It is indeed.
Now, why is it that these are so special?
Well, I mean, Hatch Chilies are a green New Mexican chili from Hatch, the region around Hatch, New Mexico. And for whatever reason, the climate, the soil, the water, the rainfall, the harvest, the Hatch chilies are the most highly respected New Mexico green chilies.
What's special about the flavor?
Well, they're delicious. They're in a nice full flavor, a nice medium heat level. Get them in milder or hotter, but generally the nice medium heat level. When they ripen all the way and turn red and are dried, they can be called chili Colorado, which is red chili used to make a lot of the red chili sauces in Mexican and New Mexican food. They have a nice, good pepper flavor with good heat.
Okay. Well, we have three different levels of heat. Mild, hot, and very hot, which are the little red ones.
Yeah, and how are the very hot ones? Have you tried?
We're going to venture into the mild ones to start with. But you can't just eat them as they come. Why, first of all, do they have a season? Why do they have to be in season?
Well, one of the things people forget about is there are seasons for produce. And while you can buy green chilies all year round, they are grown and harvested in different areas. And in the wintertime, you might be getting them from Mexico or South America or Central America, but in North America, and especially New Mexico, which is, it's not California, it's not hot all the time. They have a winter and a summer there. I mean, they plant the peppers like here in the spring, and they ripen and ready to go at the end of the summer, also like here. So in your garden, you have a bunch of peppers you're picking, and you know, in New Mexico, it's a similar thing. So it's harvest time. It's, you know, good old-fashioned. Here we're picking corn, and we're picking tomatoes, and we're picking peppers, and in Hatch, New Mexico, they're picking their chilies.
And why do you think the Hatch is so good? Is it just like a
terroir?
It's a wonderful mixture of climate and dirt.
Yeah, I think they're delicious chilies. I think they have delicious marketing. So I think that those two things together really work well for the Hatch chili.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of marketing. We got our batch from Frieda's, and it came with a little note that said that people go so crazy over these that they sell out in season. And
Yeah, they do. I mean, we pre-order for our Hatch Chili Festival, the Mamex. We pre-order the peppers we need, and we get them shipped in, but it's one-shot deal. You know, we get, two shipments into our produce people, and they send them out to all of us, and then they're gone.
So. Okay, but you don't do this. They told me that that people, they char them, put them with their skin in a freezer bag and freeze them for the rest of the year.
That's what some people do. A couple years ago at home, I bought myself a bushel of Hatch chilies.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, that was more than I kind of expected it to be, and I took them home, and I built a nice fire in my my grill with some wood and some charcoal, and then I roasted them all over the coals. I mean, you've roasted peppers before. You know, you roast them so the skin blackens. Then covered them up and let them steam, and then I peeled them and put them in baggies to freeze them. Of course, doing a whole bushel, I wasn't wearing gloves or anything to protect my hands. And so by the end of the the task, I had two buckets of ice water, one on either side of my chair, and I would alternate hands in the buckets of ice water so I could finish the job. And they were hot chilies. But even the mild ones, after a while, will get hot. But, yeah, so what I did is I roasted them, and then I pulled off the skin and pulled out the seeds and sort of laid them flat and then put them in baggies and froze them. And when I wanted some, I would pull out a baggie and just pull the frozen chunk of chili block off. If I was going to chop them up, I'd cut a piece off. Or if I wanted them whole, I would defrost the whole bag and pull them out. The chili festival, we just get enough fresh to make fresh items, and then when it's done, it's done.
Now, you peel the skin off.
Peel the skin off. So, yeah, just roast it hard. Over fire, or, you know, as you were saying, on a hot iron surface, and then skin off.
See, what I was planning to do tonight with my dinner, and maybe this is the wrong thing, I was actually going to core them and cut them into slices.
Well, you can do that, too.
And that's the way I fixed the fish dish I plan to make with these chilies tonight.
And you can take the hatch chilies, and you can, you know, treat them like a green chili or a green pepper. And whatever you would do with a green pepper or green chili, you could do with them, too. I mean, if you want to slice them into a salad, you know, they're delicious, mildly spicy green peppers. If you're using the mild ones, that's great in a place you would use just a raw bell pepper.
Now, is this the right time to ask Bill about the Hatch Chili Festival?
Yeah, let's find out.
This is a really special event, and it's coming real soon, and it's not going to last very long. So get a pencil and paper handy so that you know when you're going to be able to take advantage of it.
I've been a fan of Hatch chilies for a long time. I mean, a good roasted green chili is always delicious. And some years ago, when I was finally able to make a connection to get some shipped out here fresh, started doing a Hatch Green Chili Festival at all of our Mad Mexes. And so we do a couple. We do some stuffed green chilies. We make a Hatch chili margarita. We make a Hatch chili salsa. We have a bunch of stuff, and then we run them as a special while the supplies last. So I have a 3 or 4 bags, which is a big burlap sack. I think they're about a bushel and a half. So I think 3 or 4 bags that come, one every week or one every 4 days, so to the Mad Mexes, and we do it till the chilies are gone.
So you're starting when?
Starting on the 21st, or should I say it started on the 21st, which was last Wednesday. And we'll run it about 3 weeks as long as we can keep getting chilies.
Yeah, and they're late this year, I heard.
I've seen them come in as late as the beginning of September and as early as the end of July.
Okay.
So we always have to be kind of flexible, you know, with what we're doing. We plant them, and then we sort of wait till they get ready and then get it going.
Now, can people go straight to a Mad Mex website to find out where the restaurants are?
Yes, sir. MadMex.com, and tells you where all the Mad Mexes are. You can find out what's on the draft list, and you can see what's on the menu and come on in.
And get there sometime in the next 3 weeks if you want to be part of a Hatch Chili Festival.
Yes.
While I have you on the phone, I started asking you, Mad Mex was your first entry into the restaurant scene in Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah, Mad Mex actually having its 20th birthday at the end of October.
Wow.
So Mad Mex Oakland opened 20 years ago this October.
I remember it. I was there.
You're probably going to close South Highland Avenue again, like you did for the last 4 months.
You can't blame that mess on me.
I can't, but maybe you'll need to close the street for the 20th anniversary, huh?
Yeah, you know, if we knew the street was going to be closed so long, we might have done a bit of a street party.
Yeah,
but
I
it looks like they've got the deck
that.
Of the bridge paved.
The official word from the dry cleaner across the street?
Yes.
Is the 9th of September they're going to reopen.
The 9th of September?
Yeah, and it can't happen sooner for us either.
Well, I called Bill Peduto's office yesterday afternoon, and they said October.
No, see if you believe Bill Peduto or you believe the laundryman.
I think the dry cleaner might be closer to the connection.
I think, because he probably talks to the guys all the time. They're almost right next door.
Yeah. They still have a lot of work to do, though.
Yeah.
Well, they better get busy, isn't they? we're fed up with driving around it. I'm sure you are, too.
Oh, it's terrible. I got it figured out now. You know, I got my plan, but it would be nice when it's gone.
Right.
Bill, can you encapsulate your Big Burrito restaurant group in addition to how many Mad Mexes now do you have and where are they?
So we have 11 Mad Mex restaurants.
Okay.
One in Columbus, one in State College, two in Philadelphia, one near the universities, and one in a suburb called Willow Grove. And then we have 7 here in Pittsburgh. And then we have some other restaurants, Kaya, which is Latino Caribbean, Soba, Pan Asian, Umi, upscale Japanese,
which is
a lot of
wonderful
sushi, which is very nice. 11, Modern American Fine Dining.
I love 11.
Kasbah, which is across the street practically from you guys.
That's my neighborhood, restaurant.
which is, what do we call that, a Mediterranean kitchen and wine bar.
Right.
And we have a catering company.
Called Big, huh?
Big Catering, and I think that's it.
When are you going to do a new concept?
I'd love to do a new concept someday.
Yeah. Now, you started out, I guess, as chefing at Kasbah, right?
I started out when we opened Kaya, which was the spring of 95.
Uh-huh.
And then I opened Kasbah as the executive chef. I did that for a while and then ran some of the restaurants here and there. And I eventually my big chef role, it's been a long time ago, 15 years ago, 14 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I often wonder, I mean, would you like to just jump back into the line?
Well, you know, I get in and out of the restaurants and I help when we're short-staffed or with special events or when we're working on some stuff. But going, you know, have a lot of different things to do all the time is pretty awesome. Although it would be nice just to have one restaurant wrapped around me and just focus on one set of problems and one set of people, you know, kind of drill down and do that.
I remember when we had the most fun. It was when you got back from Thailand.
Oh, man, that was awesome. I spent a month in Thailand and came back.
We would go to Soba and we would say, Bill, what do you want to cook for us based on what you saw in Thailand this time?
Yeah, and it was great. And if you remember the patio, I had herbs and peppers. I had lemongrass and cilantro.
Wow.
And
I remember it well.
Lots of hot peppers. I would just go out and grab stuff and cook it up. It was a fun time.
Maybe I ought to do that every once in a while now, just for fun.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about your radio program, too, which I thought was an interesting concept. Explain that.
Well, it's on YEP on Friday mornings, and we call it Pairings. And what happens is Cindy Howes, the morning DJ, will play a song, and I'll match some sort of food or menu to it, and then I'll write some sort of food or menu, and then she'll match up a song or music to go with it that sort of correlates. How the things correlate depends on our mood of the day, and sometimes it's sort of a very literal thing. Maybe she'll play an artist who's got a very New Orleans sound, and it'll make me think about some meal I had sometime in New Orleans or some New Orleans-style food. And sometimes it just sort of matches a mood, like a song will create a scene in my mind, and I'll say, well, this song sort of feels like this kind of scene. It feels like a fall day, and I've been out hiking all day, and I'm kind of tired and just sitting down to dinner, and so I want to have, a nice stew and a glass of red wine. And so we have a lot of fun with it, and we do it. And the way it started out, I would text her in the morning. Sometimes I'd be driving to work, and she would play a song, and we would joke around via Twitter, actually. And I would tweet to her, oh, I can see this song sounds like blah, 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 blah. And then we went back and forth, and finally she said, hey, let's do this on the air. And so we've been doing it over a year now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been following nationally this whole thing of playlists and restaurants has become a big thing, especially in the kitchens.
Well, Cindy now, kind of coming out of this, is doing a lot of our playlists in the restaurant. So she's building playlists and working with us to sort of pick songs and music to for the restaurants, and it's she does a great job at it.
Bill, I mean, I know you're just on vacation and you're smothered with work just coming back. I really appreciate your coming on and talking about it because this Hatch thing is so timely.
I really appreciate you having me come on.
Well, I mean, I just would like to wrap it by saying that I don't know of any other restaurateur or group that has elevated the restaurant scene in Pittsburgh the way you have. And now you're making national news. So you've put us on the map.
Well, thank you very much.
and have a great Hatch Chili Festival.
If I'm over at Shady Side, I hope I run into you guys.
You can stop by anytime and pick herbs from our garden.
Awesome.
Okay, Bill. Ciao, huh?
And we'll be back with a little more local Pittsburgh bragging right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Thanks for staying with us. And next up, we're going to be talking to an old friend and two new acquaintances,
including one up-and-coming chef and a communications person who explained the whole concept to us. But what got us going to Bar Marco is because out of all the many restaurants in the whole country, it was listed on as one of the 50 best new restaurants in the whole greater USA.
And they were so excited. The only thing is, I guess a week or so later, they had a little bit of a letdown because they found out they didn't make the top 10.
Yeah, that's tough.
But making the top 50 is pretty clever act, and this is a pretty clever place to go. You can have a whole lot of fun, as we did the evening that we spent there. So here's the gang from Bar Marco.
We've got a story here. We've got three people to help us tell that story. It's Bar Marco, and the story keeps changing. Let's start with a little basic information. Could we talk to Elena Weber, who's their communications director? Just a little background. What is this? Is it a bar? Is it a restaurant? How old is it?
Yeah, absolutely. So Bar Marco started, the story is four high school friends, Bobby Fry, Justin Steele, Kevin Cox, and Michael Crea. They were friends since high school, and so they opened this place. Justin started out in the kitchen. Bobby does business strategy. Michael designed and renovated the entire number 7 firehouse, so where you're sitting right now, the bar, all the tables are custom made. Their hands and fingerprints are all over this place. They've poured everything into it. So they opened this place. It's a cocktail bar, and we have light snacks on the menu as well. We have serve our full menu until 2 a.m.
Well, it's really one night. Out space, and it's historically significant in this renovated firehouse. And you have so many activities that go on. Now, we're going to be talking to the chef, or we're going to be talking to your cocktail designer partner in a minute, but tell us just a little bit of some of these. I'm interested in No Menu Monday.
Yeah, No Menu Monday is really awesome. So when Bar Marco first opened, we were closed on Monday and Tuesdays. No Menu Monday came out of the idea that a lot of restaurants are closed on Mondays. So what can we do with that? What can we do that's kind of fun and different? So basically every Monday, we man the bar as Bar Marco, our mixologists and bartenders, and then our kitchen is not the Bar Marco kitchen on Mondays. It's open to either an up-and-coming chef, someone who doesn't have access to a kitchen themselves, but they might make awesome sandwiches. And so they have the opportunity to come into the kitchen, put their food costs out, and then make all of the profits that night. The kitchen is theirs. And we also do a lot of sort of morphed into doing fundraisers with community partners as well.
What about the cooking with kids school?
Yeah, so this year we started Food Revolution Pittsburgh. So at Obama High School in East Liberty, we go every Tuesday, and for a few hours in the afternoon, it's an official school club. We bring a local celebrity chef. They teach the kids basic cooking skills, so how to cut potatoes, how to cut carrots, knife skills, things that transfer really easily into economic opportunities for them, jobs after college, possibly culinary school. So we give them tools and access to chefs, and then through that experience are really, really seeing change in their lives. Every kid walks away with their own knife, their own cutting board, their own cookbook that they choose, that they cook recipes out of over the course of the semester. This year, the semester ended with Food Revolution Day, which was a huge party that we threw in East Liberty for the community. The kids were each partnered with a different chef. We had 8 local chefs. We have about 20 kids in the cooking club. They made everything from grilled cheese to grilled chicken, barbecue chicken, and that was all them cooking right next to the chef. So this year we're looking to do another initiative in all of the schools, including bringing water to cafeterias and making fresh salad dressings there. So we've got a whole proposal in line for that.
Well, this is a place where things happen. You even have food trucks meeting up here. Let's talk, Jamilka. You have been around a bit, but you originally are from Puerto Rico. And Jamilka, you came here to go to culinary school, did you not? Tell us a little bit how you got here.
So, as any great story, I moved to Pittsburgh because I was in love, and I wanted to go to culinary school right here in Pittsburgh, where my ex-boyfriend was. And then, I ended up working for Trevitt Hooper at Legume. When Legume was still in Regent Square, I was a salad girl. I stayed there for 5 years. Like, Legume was, he's my mentor, most beautiful restaurant in Pittsburgh, I think. And I don't know, like, Pittsburgh is a great place to be. Like, I made a bunch of friends, and I like it here. The food scene has changed so much, and then Bar Marco happened.
Well, about Bar Marco, the food, tell us what we can eat. What will we eat tonight?
Well, let's see. I think the menu really is, like, really, it's meant to be shared by a couple or friends, or so the idea is to get, like, a couple of different things. I love the corn fritters, beans, the pork butt. Like, most of the food here have a story. Like, most of our produce come from Who Cooks For You Farm in New Bethlehem, PA. And this is people that I know. I've been working with them for 5-6 years. I've been to their house. I know who's growing my food, and it translates, like, to what is here and what's being served to you. So I guess, like, every single thing that is here, I really enjoy. I would get, like, 5 different things. Beans, fritters, like, salad, beans, pork, smelt, something like that.
Well, I'm looking for some more items. What do I have here? Mussels and fries, patatas bravas, smelts. You don't see those all over the place. I love smelts, loaded with umami and whatnot. And you have platters of meats, cheese, and you even have sweets, tart and brownie, and meatballs, anyhow, and tartare. Is the steak tartare pretty good? She's nodding her head. Okay. Now, as she said, the full menu is served until 2 a.m., and this is a place where you come to have a lot of fun and a lot of camaraderie. Now, next up, I want the word from the cocktail king of Pittsburgh, Sean Dwight Enright. What is that D Dwight for?
Dwyer,
and I thought it was Dwight. Okay, anyhow, here's Sean to tell us about the cocktail program here and how influential he was in forming the cocktail culture of Pittsburgh.
Well, I guess it all started in the same building, and I was a bartender for Embry. Yeah, I've been, as you know, and we spent years together at Casbah, Cafe Allegro. I finally ended up at Embry because I wanted to learn this new thing called craft cocktailing, and Embry was really the only place doing it in the city here in the original, the preceding Firehouse Lounge. So I learned the craft cocktailing scene here. Obviously other bartenders in the city were seeing what we were doing at Embry, and they came in. They would come in every night. I'd have a full bar of local bartenders who are working in the other restaurants, other bars in the city. And it just sort of spread like wildfire. Within a year, we had our first United States Bartenders Guild Pittsburgh chapter. The basic idea was just making craft cocktails, taking your time, using freshest ingredients, measuring everything out. Craft cocktailing is a lot like our chef, where you just throw Red Bull and vodka together in a glass. You take your time, you measure it out, you muddle, and use the best ingredients you possibly can.
I have a question, since I know you so well, I can ask it. There's a big difference between, from my point of view, and I'm not a cultured cocktail person, but there's a huge difference between the West Coast and the East Coast. Are you more aligned with the East Coast cocktails?
Well, I am from Boston originally, so I think that my loyalty has to lie East Coast. But I think Fred Sarkis was the one who mentored me here at the Embry Bar, taught me everything I learned about craft cocktailing, and I think I fall more in line with Fred's philosophy that, you know, Pittsburgh isn't really an East Coast city. It's really, as far as cocktailing goes, really needs to consider itself more of a Midwestern city like Chicago. I would say I kind of follow along with more of the Chicago guidelines, the Violet Hour in Chicago, the Drawing Room, where they do more of that speakeasy style, pre-prohibition kind of cocktailing, whereas New York and California, they get a little more, I call it craft nouveau.
Now, Sean, I'm guessing that your bartenders can probably fix just about anything, but you have a very interesting list, and one of the more interesting things is the name of the person who designed it. He's right under the title, but how about a nuclear daiquiri? Greg de Gruyter and a lab in London. created this concoction. Sean, you're responsible for the red wedding. I don't want to begin to speculate as to where the inspiration for that came from. The Glenshaw 75, made out of Boyd and Blair vodka, distilled in Glenshaw, is a little bit easier. Where the 75 comes from, I don't know.
Well, yeah, it was based on the traditional French 75. I think the red wedding is a really cool one. That the name actually comes from the TV series and book series, The Game of Thrones. I wanted to do a Negroni that was just a little bit different style. I wanted a Negroni on the menu. Negronis are really popular now, but I didn't want to put a Negroni on. So instead of your typical straightforward Negroni, I'm using gin. I'm using Chinar in place of sweet vermouth. And I'm using Aperol, which is sort of the sweeter cousin of Campari, to try to balance out the bitterness of the Amaro Chinar. And it's just your basic Negroni build.
And just in case you're not already intrigued, how about a scallop begonia or a grimace and bear? This seems to me like that might be an action cocktail. That there's something you're supposed to do about divesting your raiment when you're drinking it. You have wines by the glass on here as well, but I'm sure you have a wine program as well.
We do. We have a large wine cellar that we're actually in the process now of redesigning so that we can actually do full wine dinners down there. And Jamilka is going to be doing the kind of food that she is used to doing at places like Lagoon, a little more creativity, like prefix menus, 10 course meals in a private dining setting. And that's going to, we're working right now on redesigning that wine cellar to really focus on this beautiful cellar that we have. By the glass is pretty limited. Like our beer list, we just want to keep it really simple on that end, you know, and just we get really boutique-y kind of wines that you won't find anywhere else, and same thing with the beer. We just want something that's nice, light. You know, people are going to come in and say, I've never heard of this, I don't know if I want to drink it. We're going to say, hey, you got to give it a try, and we're going to win them over with a great glass of wine.
Another question, because you're my friend. Are contemporary craft cocktail people anti-vodka?
No, because Boyd and Blair is the greatest vodka in the world, and you know, I think I think we're starting to come back as we were talking earlier about Tony Abuganim, and he just put out a book about vodka, and you know, I think there was sort of a vodka backlash, not because we dislike vodka by any stretch of the imagination, it's just that it doesn't offer much to craft cocktailing. Craft cocktailing's based on the idea that you should also taste the flavor of the booze. Why are you drinking a cocktail if you don't want to taste alcohol? Then you shouldn't be drinking cocktails. Vodka just gets masked by whatever is introduced to it. Whereas, you know, you do a whiskey drink such as the Bobby Fries, the Cooper, you're going to taste whiskey. And, you know, that should be the point of it. Not, and same thing with a Sazerac. You should be able to taste the flavors of rye or cognac, if that's your preference, in your Sazerac.
That's a bit of a turnaround from what I understand, because it was either Tony or Dale DeGroff, I'm not sure which, who told us that the reason cocktails got invented was mostly because the booze itself didn't taste very good. So you added things to it to mask the flavor. Now what you're saying is the world has changed a full 180 degrees. And now you're saying you want to feature the alcohol because the alcohol itself is a fine and tasty product and a critical part of any cocktail.
Yeah, I think absolutely. Back in the day when they were making gin out of bathtubs, you did not want to drink that. Nowadays, there's a lot of fine artisanal spirits, and you know the professionals who are putting out the spirits are doing their best to make a full-bodied, great-tasting spirit without some of the harsh aftertaste that you used to find.
Now we left the interesting news till the end of this conversation, but Bob Marco was recently singled out for something not just in Pittsburgh, an honor that's reserved for the very few. Why don't you conclude the interview by telling us a little bit about Elena, about what that experience was like, transitory though it was.
Yeah, so we just were nominated as top 50 by Bon Appetit magazine. top 50 nominees for new restaurants across the country. And, yeah, that morning was pretty exciting. I was on my way to the Livermore, which is our second spot, which is a cafe and cocktail bar. It's the same, very similar cocktail program as you see down here, but as we move forward, that's taking on its own personality as a cocktail program, for sure. So the Livermore opens on Friday, and I was on my way to work with lots on my mind about details for the menu and just getting everything together. We couldn't get an ice machine. Seemed like forever to get an ice machine. And I walked in, and Bobby said, "Hey, guess what? We nominated for top 50 restaurants in the country." So it was quite a surprise, and I think all of us as a team were just really thrilled. It just sort of resonated throughout the whole day, and it still is resonating with us that every day there are ordinary tasks that need to be done and things that need to be accomplished, but something like that just gives a lot of perspective and a lot of encouragement for the work that we do on a daily basis here at Bar Marco, and then the energy needed to really pour creativity and energy into a new spot. So, yeah, we're really excited.
I must say that I think that Livermore is very forward-thinking as well. You're going to have an emphasis on raw food and before and after dinner food and drinks. And it promises to be, due to its location in East Liberty, a real community investment. And since that's my neighborhood, I'm really looking forward to it.
And the good news for everybody is, and we'll conclude on this note, the Highland Avenue Bridge will reopen, according to people who know, on the 9th of September. So less than a month to go before normality returns to our neighborhood and yours. So I think it's now probably time that someone should say to us, Peter and Ann, wouldn't you like something to eat and drink?
Thank you all.
And we'll be back with a change of subject right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And we may be wandering a bit thematically, but the name of the next item certainly fits the season. It's Harvest Snaps, which is a fairly unique and addictive snack that's rather good for you if you're a snacker, because it's vegetable-based and it's baked instead of fried.
And 70% of what's in it is what the snack is called. So it's Harvest Snaps with peas and lentils in all kinds of different flavors. Really good stuff. We're going through it a bag a day. So you should hear more about it.
Steve Neepkins is what I would call a food production marketing pro. Is that true, Steve?
Yes. I'm currently the vice president of sales and marketing for Calbee North America, but all of those things work.
Okay. Yeah, and Calbee North America is who exactly?
Calbee North America is a snack food company based in Fairfield, California, that specializes in snacks and food items that first always taste good, but second of all have healthier for you benefits.
Well, I just did the recap of the Fancy Food Show for the year 2013. It's amazing how important all of those characteristics for healthy are considered important to get on your label for any snacking food, and the fact that actually more people snack than eat regular meals in this country.
That's a great point. So today, 25% of all calories are consumed through snacking.
Right.
And on average, people snack 3 times a day.
Oh, my God.
So if they're replacing their meals with some type of snack item, there's got to be some type of nutritious benefit to them. But just as importantly, if snacking is still the most emotional meal or consumption, there's got to be, you've got to feel like you're relating to this product. So, and any product, anything that you consume, you have to feel somewhat emotionally attached to, but especially in snacking. And so we always feel that if you don't have a good tasting item, then it doesn't matter what the health benefits are or what the nutritions are in the back of the pack, because you're not going to consume that item again.
No, it doesn't matter how much crispy kale you get.
Oh, please. Don't get me started on this kale.
You're just not going to fall in love with it because it doesn't taste very good.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I'm mad for seaweed. I love seaweed. But when you start toasting it and mixing it up with cheddar cheese, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, you do need to be careful on how you go about it, but
flavored seaweed, that doesn't quite do it for me.
Right.
No, but here we're talking about something I do love, which is a product line you have called Harvest Snap, which I sampled in both sweet pea in the pod variety and the lentil variety. Now, each one of those has different flavors too, right?
They do. So we've had what our brand was called Snap Pea Crisp from 1999 to 2012, when we had two variants. We had the lightly salted and the Caesar flavored, and those are very good items. They've done very well, but we wanted to relaunch this under Harvest Snaps as the umbrella brand, because there are other vegetable bases that we have currently in the innovation pipeline that we're going to be launching over the next 2 to 3 years. And the first step to the launch was introducing the lentil snaps. And per our proposition to the consumer, the base ingredient needs to be at least 65% of the final product. So, for example, our snap pea crisps are 70% pea. We mill the pea right here on site, and then we blend it with rice flour. We bake it, we season it, and we package it. That's as simple of a process as you can get. That's why it's got the healthier-for-you benefits, like the 4 to 5 grams of protein, 13% fiber, very low sodium, only 3% of your daily value of sodium. So that's the proposition that we sell. The lentil snaps are 65% lentil, also blended with rice flour, and that's why you get the nutritious benefits from eating these, because they're minimally processed.
You know, when people look at these, what do you call that, the charts in the back of the packaging, and they read like X number of calories per serving, most people don't pursue it further and read what constitutes a serving. It never ceases to amaze me how small the serving sizes are.
They are small. Oh, we follow obviously the regulations by the FDA.
Oh, sure, I'm sure you do.
But what we found is that this is a particular item that even if you go over the serving count, because it's a puffed product, and because it's the principal ingredient is, well, it's, like I said, it's 70% of the overall snack that you're eating. It's not as filling, it's not as fattening, and it's not nearly as bad for you, because the proteins and the actual salt, it's real protein, it's vegetable protein. Uh-huh. You're not getting protein from a soy, you're getting it from the actual pea or the lentil, and therefore you're not doing a disservice to your body. It doesn't mean we recommend eating 4 or 5 servings per sitting, but it's still a vegetable that you're consuming. Uh-huh. So there's a lot of positive benefits to that.
Now, I'd love to sit in on one of your R&D sessions to figure out how you come up with, first of all, your first product right out of the box was peas, sweet peas. Who would have thought of sweet peas?
Well, you wouldn't. And I'll tell you, that's the benefit of having the joint venture. Our co-owner is Artie Offit. Ron Offit is a North Dakota farmer that started with 160 acres of potato fields and has grown that into 100,000 acres of agricultural products. So Ron's been doing this, and his company, Artie Offit, have been growing vegetables in the United States. He's the largest potato grower in the world. So he knows a thing or two about agriculture, and he knows a thing or two about creating a vertically integrated business model where he can take his expertise of raw ingredients and turning that into something that can be consumed in a number of different ways.
But he has 100,000 acres?
Yes.
And they're not all potatoes.
I mean, it's like he must have his own section in the farm bill.
He is a very influential individual in the agricultural sector. There's no question about it. But he's also a very humble man who knows where he came from, and he believes strongly in creating items that are better for you and trying to minimize the processing And he's a great partner with Kelby because Kelby, the name Kelby comes from calcium and vitamin B.
Oh, okay.
And that was started by Mr. Matsuo in 1949 in post-World War II Hiroshima, Japan.
Oh, jeez.
And so you can imagine what the environment was like, and he realized that people were lacking in calcium and vitamin B, so he created a snack that was rich in calcium and vitamin B, hence the name Kelby. And so we have two owners that have grown up in the world of agriculture and trying to make a difference in people's lives with food.
Well, that's absolutely amazing. Now, here's a bit of diversification for you that we came across that maybe Mr. Offit would be interested in, maybe not. This is an English potato farmer. Then they branched out into making potato chips, and their potato chips were so good that they won the Gold Sophie as the best new product at the Fancy Food Show the year they launched it. Then the next year they came back, they were making vodka with all the leftover pieces of potato.
Those are the type of people that creative conceptual where there should be no waste. Those are people that really drive innovation in our life. I mean, that's really exciting. That's not too different from Ron having has the largest dairy, I believe, in the United States, in Oregon. His dairy is one of the only full circle dairy in the United States, meaning that all of the waste from the cows produces the energy. The milk goes to create Tillamook cheese.
Makes Tillamook cheese.
Yeah, Tillamook. Have you tried Tillamook cheese?
Oh, sure.
It's fantastic. It's a really good cheese. I'm from Wisconsin, so I know a thing or two about cheese.
You're a cheesehead.
I am a cheesehead, believe it or not. And so these are the types of individuals, these entrepreneurs that create fully sustainable business models that are just fun to be associated with.
Right. Can you put on your radar for the future and where are we heading with snacks?
Well, where we're heading with snacks is I believe we've heard the call of problems in this country with obesity, diabetes, and just lack of activity in our children today. And I would tell you, first and foremost, and I said this at the beginning, if you don't have something that tastes good, you might as well forget it. Because if functional foods are great, as long as there's an emotional tie to that food. Mm-hmm. And without it, I think you're going to see more functional foods that taste better because the repeat purchase grows if you like something. If you don't like it, you're not going to go back. It's like anything. You're not going to buy a car or use car salesman if you don't like them.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's the same with food. Why would we put something in our body that we don't, even though we know it might be good for us, it's really hard to overcome the taste buds. So I think you're going to see a greater focus on unique flavors. So, for example, we have a tomato and basil lentil that we could have done a barbecue lentil. We could have done a cheese-flavored lentil.
I've tasted that. That's quite good.
It's really good. We use real tomatoes and we use real basil. And I think you're going to find more and more snack food. The taste profile is raised to a whole new, we're taking the ceiling off the taste, and we're finding really unique flavors that blend well with the first ingredient to create a more exciting snacking time, as well as it's also healthier for you. Trying to eliminate the processing, it's just like we were talking earlier, the center of the store is not where the growth area is in grocery. It's at the perimeter of the store. It's the getting back to as close to the natural product as possible.
Well, if that's the case, then I think that you're working for a company that's going in the right direction. You won't give us a clue to what's in the pipeline because you indicated there was something.
Well, if you can think of other pulses and beans.
Chickpeas.
Oh, there you go. So I didn't have to reveal any of our inner secrets. You figured that out on your own.
They're really good. Chickpeas.
They are good. And again, you look at the health benefits of eating chickpeas, black beans.
And
all of those things.
Edamame.
All of those things are packed with nutrients. And if we have found a way to maintain the nutrition, even though we're still a manufacturing plant, but we're finding ways to still keep that nutrition packed inside each lentil or each pea or each black bean, add an exciting flavor to it, and now you're getting all the nutritional benefits that you would almost from a raw product, but yet add some exciting flavors to it. So, yeah, our pipeline is filled, and we've got a number of things that we're going to be launching next year and then in 2015. So we're only beginning to tap into parent companies, one that grows the product and the other one that can innovate that product. So it's fun. It's a great time to be involved with Calbee North America.
Well, you sound like you're having a great time, Steve.
Yes, Steve, thank you. And Harvest Snaps are on the top of Anne's favorite list right now, and I see no reason why they wouldn't stay there. So thank you so much for that, too.
Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. And keep pushing for better nutrition and things that taste good.
And we'll be talking about more things that taste good right after the break, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We have, I would think, a household name in that of Chef Jose Andres, and we probably have a whole new standard for our pantry of specialty Spanish foods, authentic, delightful, made available through this food line. We have the person, Enrique Padro, who's responsible for organizing all of this for Jose, and he's going to talk to us about the good things you can get that's almost as good as visiting the country of origin.
All fairy tales begin once upon a time in English. Now, I'm not sure how they begin in Spanish, and in Spanish they possibly don't live, and they lived happily ever after. But anyway, once upon a time, there was a young man called Jose Andres. And Jose Andres worked in the most famous kitchen in the world, probably, at a restaurant called El Bulli, in a little place called Roses in Spain. And then, for reasons that we never really entirely understood, he decided instead to seek his fortune in the United States. And Miss Anne, 20 years ago at least, met Chef Jose Andres at his first restaurant in Washington, D.C. And the rest, as they say, is history. We're talking today to
Enrique Padro.
Enrique Padro, who is in charge of possibly the latest part of Jose's venture, a venture to bring the best of Spanish food into the United States. Welcome, first of all. Hola, Enrique.
Hola. Thank you very much. How are you?
Now, is there a title to this line of food and this particular operation as part of Jose's business dealings? What do you call this product line of foods?
Well, we have created a new company that is part of the group. The company is called Sinfu Products, and it's dedicated to that. It's dedicated to creating this brand, to selecting the partners, to selecting the products, to bringing these products into the state and market them. So that's what this company is doing.
What's the relationship between that and a business called Fermin?
There is no corporative relation, but there is, of course, there is story in common. I mean, Fermin was the first Spanish company that could bring the ham, Iberico ham, which for me is the best in the world, the American market.
Oh, so it was specialized. It was specialized around the ham.
Oh yeah, it was the only thing they had.
Okay, very good.
So you know about Iberico. So Fermin was the first company allowed by the American government because they were accomplishing all the regulations that you have for importing this product here in Spain. And they partnered up with Jose like 10 years ago, and they brought the Iberico ham here. So that was the first food product that they brought into the States. And Jose was also using his name to be a speaker and to tell the market about this product and to teach the people about this product and all that. And that's something very similar to what we are doing now. So we are, in Sinfu Products, we are doing the same thing that they did in Fermin, so bringing a very good Spanish product and marketing it in the States with Jose Andres. But the difference is that we are not a producer. Fermin is a producer, and we are not specialized in one product, but we are creating a range with our partners, with our small manufacturers of different products all around Spain.
You know, we should mention, Enrique, that you are the founding partner and are the managing director of this whole line, Jose Andres Foods. And we should also mention that Jose is no longer a small-time chef and restaurateur, but is the head of a huge empire and has been named outstanding chef by the James Beard Foundation. And he's also on the faculty at Harvard, as I understand it, right?
Yes.
So I wanted to say that I've always felt that in addition to producing the very best bar none hams in the whole entire world, I think that the Spanish jarred and tin products are also the finest in the world of that mode of food.
I think so. I totally agree with you.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
And that's one of the challenges we have in the American market, because I think that Americans know how good olive oil is, or Americans know how good white tuna from the Basque Country is, but Americans still are a little bit reluctant, not foodies, but I mean the main market. They are not really understanding that something very, very, very exclusive and unique can be in a can. That's one of the things we want to tell the market.
You're saying that Americans, I think, naturally assume that something in a can must somehow be not necessarily very good.
Exactly. And that's because I think that because of your story, you were, well, not America, but the whole world. I mean, start using the can for military campaigns, so maybe you are relating cans to survival or something like that and not to gastronomy. But the reason why the Spanish producers are putting the seafood in a can, fresh seafood in a can, is because you can enjoy this product for all the year, and you can enjoy this product for, you can buy it and you can enjoy it during 5 years. I mean, it has a long life. That's one of the reasons. Actually, you told me before that you've been in Barcelona several times. I don't know if you have been to a restaurant called Quimet?
Yes, we have, actually.
So that's giving you an idea of what you can do with a sea urchin in a can, or with a cockle in a can, or with a clam can. They are doing, for me, it's one of the best restaurants in Europe, and they are only using cans.
Yes, and you have a number of categories that you draw from, but it's all artisanal, isn't it? Small producers?
Yes.
And some of the categories include olive oils and sherry vinegars. And I think that the outstanding sherry vinegar producer is certainly Spain, and it's also the largest olive producer in the world.
Yes, it is.
Then you have seafood tapas. Now, mm-hmm. Is that what you'd classify? I had this fabulous sardines in escabeche. Is that in that category?
Yes.
Oh, I loved it. I mean, I don't know how many people were supposed to eat that can, but I ate the whole thing myself.
I do the same thing, so I don't blame you.
And then you have tapas party basic. Now, we had those too, but Peter ate those, the potato chips.
Oh, yeah, I ate the whole bag. I didn't even stop.
These potato chips are amazing. The secret with these potato chips, the raw material you are using, which is very good potato from Spain called agria, then extra virgin olive oil, which is another thing that we want to make sure people differentiate, people understand the difference between extra virgin olive oil, that it's basically an olive juice with no chemicals, and olive oil. Olive oil is just, then they take this olive and they use chemicals to produce more. So it's two different things,
yeah.
Extra virgin olive oil and oil. And then Himalayan salt. And the main thing, the main secret of this chip, the method, because at the end you can, any company could use these raw materials, but then when it comes to the method, they are cooking at a slow temperature. And what means that they are cooking at a slow temperature? You know that when you are cooking with, not with olive oil, with any material at high temperature, there is a molecular transformation, and the olive oil is not olive oil anymore, or the butter is not butter anymore, or so from the chemical point of view. And when you're cooking at a slow temperature, you are preventing this to happen. And preventing this to happen means that the product is much more healthy, that all the attributes of the extra virgin olive oil sticks on. So that's, I mean, if you have tasted them, you have noticed the difference between these chips and other chips produced by huge companies.
Now, it means that if you're lusting after patatas bravas, but you can't get any because they only make them in Spain, you can have these instead.
Yes. And you can make an omelette as well with the chips, and you can use them as a base. We love to eat them underneath a mussel. So you are using the chip as a tapa base, and then you put a mussel on top, and it's a great tapa.
And now, what is the next category? Vegetable classics.
Vegetable classics. This, we are doing it with our partner in Navarra.
Okay.
They are called Rosara. Navarra is a very well-known area in Spain for vegetables because of the conditions where you are producing the best vegetables and long, in a longer period of time. And we have selected three products. Calibada. Calibada is a traditional Catalan plate made with eggplant, with piquillo pepper, with onion. Then we have pisto, with excellent complement for anything, for fish, for a meat, for an omelette, for a fried egg, just like French ratatouille, basic. But the raw material is a little bit different, but it's something like that. Maybe it's a little bit sweeter, so Americans will like it more. And then the tomate frito that Jose has chosen this product because he's using it a lot in pasta sauce, base, as many, many things. It's a very versatile product.
Well, the one product's better than the next. How do people get a hold of them? You sell retail as well as wholesale?
Yes. We created this company last year. We got off last February, but officially we just launched the line a couple of months ago. So we are going step by step. I mean, now we are in the smaller stores around the country. From October, we will be, for example, in Whole Foods, in our
oh, that's
region,
good.
In Maryland, in Virginia, in D.C. We will be also in the Wegmans in New Jersey. We will have some products in Central Market in Texas and many other places. We also have a website where people can find us wherever they are.
And the website is?
JoseAndresFoods.com.
Well, if you want to imagine that you're sitting at a tapas bar in the Boqueria in Barcelona, here's how you can make that work at home. All you need to do is choose the wine to go along with it, and you have a party.
Yes.
Well, have you been well received so far, Enrique?
Yes.
So I guess you're getting all the top shops now, stores like Whole Foods. Have restaurants shown an interest in using it?
Some products, yes, but this line, I think that great chefs know where to get good products for the restaurants. Jose has a lot of good friends among the best chefs, and he's advising them, and they are advising him about products and all the time. But at the end, it is a product for the consumer, at the product for retail. We have used Jose brand for one very simple reason. Well, actually, we are using Jose's brand, but we are co-branding it with the supplier. And the reason why we are using Jose's brand, it's because we think that you can have the best product in the world, and you can be the best producer in the world with all the passion and all the everything, but if you don't have the tools to tell the market, people is not going to enjoy that. And we want as many Americans as possible to enjoy this product, and I think that Jose brand him, and they will taste the products and love them.
Well, we thank you so much for sharing some of them with us and for sharing your thoughts about this new venture. We wish you great success. Although
very
I don't know that our good wishes are really needed, but we
yeah,
give them to
always,
you anyway.
Always welcome.
and please say hola to Jose the next time you see him.
I will see.
And don't forget, tell him he's hot.
Yeah, he will be happy about that.
I'm not sure we like that. I have a feeling that might hit the cutting room floor.
Okay, Enrique.
Thank you very much.
Yes, bye, dear. John.
Bye-bye.
And that's a wrap, as they say, for this week's program. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.